What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Abigail Pogrebin, author of the new book, My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Maven on Israel, Oshrat Borel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Purim Sameach. It's the wonderful, dizzy holiday of Purim today, single most fun day of the whole Jewish year. The usual approach to religion includes such important concepts as respect, reverence, and sanctity. Religion can be serious indeed. Today, however, is a reversal of all that. Purim is our springtime blowout festival in which all seriousness is forbidden and all bets are off. Actually, even betting, normally discouraged in Jewish tradition, is okay on Purim. Based on the events in the Book of Esther in the Hebrew Bible, Purim celebrates the way that the Jewish Persian courtier Mordechai outwitted the evil Persian courtier Haman and saved our people from destruction. The great heroine of the story is Queen Esther, known as Hadassah, and we rejoice in this tale of switched fortunes and salvation from annihilation by chanting the whole Megillah, literally the entire scroll of Esther, by drinking to excess, again, not a Jewish tendency, but especially reserved for this day of wild partying, and by eating to excess, a very Jewish tendency. We bring friends and relatives shalach monas, mishloach manot, gifts of sweets, fruits, and nuts to make the holiday more festive still. On Purim, children and adults dress up in costumes and act out the story of Purim, often in parody form with music and dance. It's a great way to embrace the joy of Judaism, to blow off steam and just generally enjoy the first festival of spring, even before it's actually, technically, springtime. The Megillah reading and the plays, songs, and dances are followed, at least at my own Temple Emmanuel here in Tucson, Arizona, with a big carnival of rides, games, food, and hamantaschen pastries, those triangular cookies of much delight, the best-tasting food known to all humanity. Purim is a great day to enjoy being Jewish and alive. In the spirit of Purim, to play us in, here's a Purim song of the Jews of the Sephardic world, Kichlot Yeni, Bring Me Wine, Not Water Today, from the group The Voice of the Turtle, and their Purim recording, The Sword of the Dove. Kichlot Yeni, Tereni, Kichlot Yeni, Tereni, Kichlot Yeni, Tereni, Algemayim, Algemayim. Shivim Hema Hagiborim, Yachidum Kishisarim, Shavtu Shirim, Kifisharim, Algemayim, Algemayim.
Allgemein, allgemein. Ich wollte gerne,
That was for Purim today, the Sephardic song Kichlot Yeni. In less than an hour at my own Temple Emmanuel, we'll be parodying the Gene Wilder classic musical Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory as Esther and the Hamantaschen Factory. That's at 10 a.m. If you can, join us in person at 225 North Country Club Road here in Tucson, Arizona. It's free. If not, tune in on our tetucson.org website and watch the HD live stream, also free. Also in the spirit of Purim and the reversal of fortunes so central to this wonderful holiday, the World Baseball Classic is going on right now, and a team that was a 200-to-1 shot to win it or even qualify for the tournament has now won its first two games in the first round and qualified for the second round. That's right. It's the not-so-world-famous Israeli national baseball team, 41st in the World Baseball Confederation rankings, but first in our two Jewish hearts. While most teams in the World Baseball Classic are filled with Major League All-Stars, the Israel team has Jewish guys who are marginal big leaguers or played in the minors or even retired a couple years ago. Israel got to the tournament by beating Great Britain, not exactly a famous baseball country either. But then in the first round, Israel miraculously defeated South Korea and Taiwan, teams ranked third and fourth in the world, right after Japan and the USA. We don't know how long this miracle ride will continue for Team Israel with Jewish stars like Jason Marquis and Nate Freiman, but we'll take its amazing success so far as a personal Purim baseball miracle. Mazel tov to the Israel national team in the World Baseball Classic, the True Boys in Blue. In that same holiday spirit, our guest this morning, Abigail Pogrebin, is the author of the brand new book, My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. Abigail Pogrebin ventured throughout the Jewish world, exploring just what each Jewish holiday was like in a wide variety of settings. Find out what she discovered on this wonderful journey when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lauriella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Lauriella sent you.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Abigail Pogrebin, a former 60 Minutes producer, is the author of Stars of David, Prominent Jews Talk About Being Jewish, and has written and appeared on all kinds of TV shows. Her new book is called My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. It's terrific. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
So, as a rabbi, I want to know how you chose which Jewish communities to go to for which holidays.
Yeah, I basically was guided by my curiosity more than anything, and also kind of by word of mouth. So, for instance, on Simchat Torah, which is, as you know, when we finish the Torah cycle and dance with the scrolls, I kind of would ask around. I'm sort of a collector of rabbis because I've interviewed a whole bunch and met a whole bunch and respect all of you so deeply. But I kind of have a network that I can turn to at moments like that. And I basically would say, for instance, where is the place to be for Simchat Torah? And everyone in New York City, basically it was unanimous, said essentially the Studio 54 of Simchat Torah is at B'nai Jeshurun. So that was an example of where there was actually unanimity that's where you should go for the kind of biggest shindig, the most uplifting celebration, which is not to say others wouldn't have been equally uplifting, but that's where I headed. And for instance, on Hoshana Rabbah, which until I did this book, I didn't even know was a holiday, someone said you should head over to the Karlbach Shul, which is a much more Orthodox shul. B'nai Jeshurun, as you know, is a conservative shul. So I was really guided by, what people who live this tradition and live this calendar much more closely than I ever did. And I also tried to vary the denomination. I didn't want to just stay kind of in one approach to Judaism, because part of my thesis for the book, which I think really proved true, is that there's magic and there's teaching and there's growth for a wandering Jew or a wandering Jew wherever you go.
You know, we tend to think that the Jewish festival cycle is ridiculously full of holidays. Those of us who are in this business, I'm not sure that most Jews know about most of them. Did you get that feeling that you were going from holiday to holiday to holiday without break?
It's such a good question. I did. I felt like, especially in the fall, as you know, when they come fast and furious, and particularly because I was researching them, then going to experience them, and then going home to write about them. And before I would know it, you know, as I'm finishing one sentence, I'm realizing I'm heading headlong into the next. But one thing that was the biggest takeaway from this entire year for me of immersion was that there's tremendous power in the fact that there are so many. And that may sound Pollyanna-ish, as if, you know, it's sort of like the quote-unquote right answer, but I really discovered that the Jewish tradition forces you to slow down, to pause, and to notice basically continually throughout your year. And for someone like me, who you could guess because I'm a neurotic New Yorker, is kind of racing through my life, this was a year that in, I think, profound ways slowed me down, which is not to say that I was no longer kind of a person in a hurry, but it really forced me to mark time, to mark relationships, and frankly, to look at myself more honestly than I ever did before. So I actually think there's kind of a larger purpose. It's not just that these things, you know, that there's a lot of them, but that there's a mindfulness that it requires.
We will talk much more with Abigail Pogrebin. Her new book is My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew, a wonderful gallivant through all of the Jewish holidays in the cycle. We'll hear more about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates serving Tucsonians living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Vienna, and we'll go on to talk about Budapest and Prague, places I just recently visited with which you've had long association and experience. You know, when we think about Vienna, just to finish up on that, the golden age of the Jewish community in Vienna, we think about as the end of the 19th century into the 20th, from the period of full emancipation, people like Sigmund Freud and Theodor Herzl and eventually Viktor Frankl, great figures, and a very
also artists and musicians.
Great artists, great musicians.
Right? Klimt, Mahler, Schoenberg, I mean, lots of people.
Everybody.
a field about which I know nothing, but I know the names.
Klimt, although not Jewish, painted all of the glitterati of the Viennese Jewish community. But that community ended, and although there is some continuity in general, it's left kind of a hole in Austrian society. And I think they still perceive that, but only began to acknowledge their responsibility in the Holocaust fairly recently, in the last 20 years or so.
Well, that's still an extremely difficult subject for Austrians, because they see themselves as the Nazis' first victims. We tend to see them as the Nazis' first converts
or collaborators.
Their most willing lieutenants.
Right.
I mean, we have one picture of them. They have a very different self-image. And it's not clear when you compare the German Empire to little Austria as it was in the 1930s, when it was no longer a great multinational empire. It was a shrunken, shriveled little nut, a kernel of its former self. And it wasn't sure of its own identity. It wasn't sure if it should be part of Germany or not. Nobody knew, and nobody still knows, what is an Austrian? Their language is different from German, different enough that in EU, European Union documents and treaties, there is a German version and an Austrian version, because a lot of these treaty documents have to do with agricultural products and very basic foods, things as basic as potatoes, tomatoes, apricots, mushrooms, have different names in German and in Austrian. So you can't...
Even though Austrian is a Germanic language, it's in the family.
Many people would say it's a dialect of German, but there are Austrians who would dispute that. And the terms of the European Union architecture treat Austrian as a different language. And there are, you know, different documents. There's a German version and an Austrian version, because so much of it has to do with agriculture. So, you know, the relationship between Austria and Germany has always been tenuous. There was a famous war over the Austrian succession between the Austro-Hungary of the Habsburgs and Prussia, which was the predecessor state to modern Germany. And Jews were famously blamed for collaborating with Prussia, which was untrue. And Maria Theresa signed an expulsion order expelling all the Jews from the ancient community of Prague. And it was never carried out. And this is an extremely interesting case study, which if you or your listeners don't know about this, you ought to, because in this period, long before the Enlightenment, long before the emancipation, 50 years before the French Revolution, the Jews of Europe all had access to royal courts. Even though they weren't citizens, they couldn't vote, they lived in ghettos, but the court Jews, the Hofjuden, had access to the kings and queens and emperors' ears. And all the states of Western Europe and the Ottoman Empire sent emissaries to Maria Theresa saying, rescind this order. We don't want to put the ancient Jewish community of Prague on the roads of Europe as refugees.
Fascinating. You know, the more you dig in these parts of the world, the more you find. It's always a complicated picture.
Absolutely.
We'll talk more next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Na in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat. Chag Purim Sameach.
Chag Sameach, Rabbi.
Purim is considered a kid's holiday in America, but in Israel, it's just crazy. Like, everybody dresses up and shoots silly string at each other, and I don't know, it's just a different kind of feeling. Tell us about your experience of Purim.
Okay, I'll start with here, okay? Here, in order to feel Purim, you need to go to the synagogue, right?
Absolutely.
And enjoy...
My synagogue especially, of
definitely,
course.
And to enjoy the... What's the name?
Spiel, the play, the not only the whole Megillah, but also we do our extravaganza at 10 o'clock this morning.
Vidyuk. Right. And then you feel Purim. But yeah. Then you go outside, nothing.
Right.
In Israel, 3 days, you see cowboys, you see cactus, you see Malkat Esther. For 3 days, Elsa all over, you know.
Yeah, I know.
We have like
Elsa Frozen has become the new Queen Esther of the
and
world.
And it's all over. It's in the workplace. No school, by the way. No school. We have like Friday, they will, you know, will go with their
costumes,
Mishloche Manot and costumes,
oh,
and
right.
Will
and by the way, Mishloche Manot, the food gifts that we give to each other on Purim, just so everybody can enjoy.
Bidiuk. and they will have a carnival, less than extravaganza at Temple Emmanuel, but
course,
something, you know, modest.
Big, but not bad.
But 3 days, it's a Jewish Halloween, you know,
right.
Just party, party, drinking, seudot, like feast, Purim feast. You know, they forgot about the fast, but they are feasting.
Right, there's supposed to be a fast of Esther before the feast, yeah. But everybody remembers
but
the feast.
Really beautiful, great time for businesses in Israel to sell costumes, to sell, you know. It's really, it's like before Thanksgiving here. Mamash.
Ah.
A lot of gifts for kids. It's always a good time to give gifts, right?
Of course.
So that's Purim in Israel.
It's really fun. You know, I'm going to mention one thing, which is a serious aspect of Purim. There's something called Matanot Le'Evyonim. You're supposed to give special charity so that even the poorest people in the community can enjoy a Freilach Purim, a celebratory Sameach, a fun Purim.
Yeah, nachon. And it's actually, I know you know better than me, that it's a mitzvah and everyone need to give something. Even the poor people need to give something in order to fulfill the mitzvah
of the
Chag.
They say the poor person can give it to someone who's even poorer than they are. You know, it's funny, the joy of Purim is supposed to be encompassing, and it's kind of in Israel, it really is like you're getting the end of winter, even in a place like Beit Shan, where it's not so cold. The end of winter, really spring is just absolutely beginning. Mm-hmm. And I just remember Purim as being this crazy fun festival after the winter. And I hope it is for you and for the
Thank
Israel
you.
Center.
One more thing, Rabbi.
Uh-huh, please.
It's also four weeks before Pesach, so it's a good, good opportunity to get rid of all the chametz.
That's
in
correct.
Yom Mishloach Manot.
Feed all the cookies you have to your children.
Chag Sameach.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John, and Chag Purim Sameach.
Woohoo! Purim's here. How fun.
It is a great holiday. It's nothing but fun. But educationally, what an interesting set of lessons we can take out
of
Purim.
Yeah, kind of, a little bit of a mixed bag there.
Isn't it?
Yeah, but I love the whole concept of just joy and celebration. There are some, you know, maybe the darker side of Purim with all the killing and the drinking. And stuff, but if you flip it around,
and Esther hides her Jewish identity in order to marry the king, you know, a little bit of stuff there,
right? So on the brighter side of Purim, you know, we get to dress up in costume, we get to get silly, and even, you know, when we kicked off the month of Adar a couple weeks back, it was just the sense of celebration and celebrating our survival and our peoplehood and being alive together and being a strong community. We have to have these peaks, you know, to kind of balance out the valleys that we walk through, too. So it's a great opportunity as a Jew to just get your party on, have a great time, and feel great about being Jewish and great about being in a Jewish community and having that communal joy together with a little bit of craziness and outrageousness within appropriate boundaries, of course.
Of course. I always like to say that Purim is proof that even God needs a good party now and then.
Oh, yeah. That's a great line. Sure. And so you just kind of throw down and, you know, we see a lot of traditional costumes, but you also, it's just wide open. So kids who have a special interest, like it's not too crazy to see Chewbacca showing up at a Purim dance, for example.
I would hope so. on Purim, we are supposed to read the Megillah, chant the Megillah.
Yeah.
And I know at Temple we teach all the kids to chant at least a verse or two of the Megillah. It's such a special experience.
Nice.
Where else can you like boo and cheer and you're encouraged to be as loud as possible in school?
Right. I was thinking of the World Cup or maybe a political rally. I don't know. But that's the neat thing because it sort of turns the day-to-day routine and, you know, the walking, not running, and, you know, the school rules and all the formality kind of flips it upside down for a day. And it's healthy to shake things up.
In doing Purim in a day school, you know, it happens to fall on a weekend this time.
Mm-hmm.
Is it more fun for you when it falls on a weekday or do you just build up to it?
Well, we build up to it because, you know, even if the actual holiday is not there, we still do our celebrating together because you have to have that opportunity. So doesn't matter if it's a Monday, Tuesday or a Sunday, whatever. We're still celebrating Purim in grand style.
Well, sason vikar, have a sason v'simcha, joy and celebration. Have a great Purim.
Chag Sameach, everybody.
Chag Sameach. When we return here on Too Jewish, we'll get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Irwin and Murray celebrated selling their raincoat business by going on a safari to Africa. One night in the jungle, they were frozen in their tracks by an ominous low roar coming from behind them. "Murray," quaked Irwin. "I heard." "Shah, look behind me. What do you see? A lion, a tiger, a leopard?" "I should know," moaned Murray. "What am I, a furrier?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Ki Tisah, the story of the golden calf. It's one of the most dramatic and, for the rabbis, distressing portions in the whole Torah. The problem is acute. According to the text of the Torah, our people witnessed the 10 plagues, were personally saved on the shore of the Sea of Reeds by God, received the direct revelation at Sinai, in short, experienced God more directly than any group in history, and then almost immediately turned around and rejected God to worship a cow made out of their own jewelry. No wonder the rabbis of the Talmud and Midrash call this week's events the Maaseh HaEgel, the awful story of the calf. How could a people, given such a clear set of signs and wonders, and even direct instruction and command, follow God for just 40 days before pursuing a weak and bovine substitute? The answer, to paraphrase Shakespeare, lies not in our God, but in ourselves. We enjoy spectacle. We are impressed by it, even awed by it. But as soon as it's gone, its effects linger a very short time. What makes us tick as human beings, what keeps us in line, is the dailiness of regular observance, rules, schedules, the kinds of laws and rituals that are very much a part of practical Judaism in later periods. We need both ritual and structure, and until these are provided in a coherent, regular way, we tend to flounder, even disastrously so, as we did in the story of the golden calf. The message is that we need more than grand ideas or sweeping spirituality. We require religion and a Jewish grounding in practice and experience, or we won't be able to remain both ethical and coherent. Without that focus, we start to worship golden calves of every kind, from our work to our pastime to our unfortunate obsessions with power and control. This week, try to incorporate a Jewish practice you haven't previously done. Study a bit of Torah, pray, do a ritual, or give some tzedakah that you haven't made a regular part of your life until now. Doing this will help connect you to the true God, and avoid the danger of worshiping your own personal golden calves. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Abigail Pogrebin, will tell us which of the 18 Jewish holidays she experienced in 18 very different Jewish settings, and which one she enjoyed the most, and which was the most surprising. All when we continue to celebrate Purim here on To Jewish today. Find out more from Abigail Pogrebin when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through 8th grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates, serving Tucsonans living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at AdvocationServices.com or call us at 616-0005.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a show of bipartisan unity, last week, all 100 members of the U.S. Senate signed a letter to high-ranking officials in the Trump administration urging them to address the increasing number of bomb threats against Jewish JCCs, schools, and organizations in recent weeks. The effort was led by senators from both parties and addressed to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, FBI Director James Comey, and Department of Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly. It came a day after another round of bomb threats against more Jewish community centers and the Anti-Defamation League. We write to underscore the need for swift action with regard to the deeply troubling series of anonymous bomb threats made against Jewish community centers, Jewish day schools, synagogues, and other buildings affiliated with Jewish organizations or institutions across the country, the senator's letter says. We're concerned that the number of incidents is accelerating, and failure to address and deter these threats will place innocent people at risk and threaten the financial viability of JCCs, many of which are institutions in their communities. There have been at least 98 threats against Jewish community centers and schools in 33 states just in 2017, according to the JCC Association of North America. The letter calls on the Trump administration to work with JCCs all around the country to determine what assistance is needed for enhanced security, as well as to investigate and prosecute those people making the threats. From our Better Very Late Than Never department, the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism, the umbrella body for conservative synagogues, approved a resolution last week allowing individual congregations to decide whether to grant membership to non-Jews. The resolution passed March 1st during a special meeting of the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism's General Assembly. It was held over the internet. Vote was 94-8 with just one abstention. United Synagogue for Conservative Judaism supports every affiliated kehillah in developing its own criteria for membership, the resolution reads, using the Hebrew word for congregation. The USCJ is a valued and trusted partner, is committed to assisting, welcoming, vibrant, and caring Jewish communities to fully engage the spiritual gifts of all community members. We celebrate the diversity among and within our kehillot and encourage the engagement of all who seek a spiritual and communal home in an authentic and dynamic Jewish setting. Let us strive to make the words of Isaiah reality in our time. My house will be called a house of prayer for all people, reads the commentary to this new standard. The proposed conservative movement resolution grew out of a commission set up last March, about a year ago, to explore ways to engage intermarried couples. The movement prohibits its rabbis from marrying or attending the wedding ceremonies of interfaith couples, though some of its synagogues celebrate intermarriages before they occur and welcome the couples after. In recent years, several conservative rabbis have protested the prohibition on intermarriage. The change was endorsed by the major conservative institutions in the U.S., including the Rabbinical Assembly, the Jewish Theological Seminary, and the Ziegler School of Rabbinic Studies. As usual, the conservative movement is making the right move very, very late. Following the reform movement's outreach to interfaith couples and families, about 36 years after the Union for American Hebrew Congregations, now called the Union for Reform Judaism, made public outreach to interfaith couples and families a centerpiece of contemporary American Reform Judaism. The conservative movement was late to ordain women rabbis, late to accept women cantors, and it was very late in accepting interfaith families into its congregations officially. Perhaps this will help the long slide of conservative Judaism from its one-time status as the most prominent movement in America into its current increasingly desperate situation. We will see.
We are stardust. We are golden. And we got to get ourselves back to the garden.
An impresario named Fred Weintraub, who's the Bitter End Coffee House in Greenwich Village, showcased most of the great young talent in music and comedy that began the 1960s, died last week at the age of 88. Fred Weintraub, who left home, family, and a baby carriage business to become the Greenwich Village impresario, advancing the careers of dozens of fledgling singers and comedians, and who later gave Bruce Lee his start in movies, as well as making the documentary Woodstock, the film that saved Warner Brothers, said, "I'm still amazed that a child born with incurable spilkus," that's the term for ants in my pants in Yiddish, "could accomplish so much." After showcasing a panoply of virtually unknown performers in the 60s, including Bob Dylan, Woody Allen, Lenny Bruce, Bill Cosby, Joni Mitchell, Randy Newman, Nina Simone, and Peter, Paul, and Mary, Weintraub became a Hollywood producer. He introduced Bruce Lee and the martial arts craze to American movie audiences and persuaded Warner Brothers to subsidize the last-minute cost of a three-day rock festival in New York in 1969. The investment resulted in the studio's Oscar-winning documentary, Woodstock. The Bitter End Club's signature stage backdrop, a bare 150-year-old brick wall, distinguished it from the other popular bohemian hangouts like the Village Vanguard. It appears on the cover of Peter, Paul, and Mary's first album. A radio show hosted by folk singer Theodore Bickel of blessed memory originated there, as did a later TV series, Live at the Bitter End. In 1963 to 1964, Fred Weintraub was the talent coordinator for Hootenanny, the weekly folk music show on ABC TV that was wildly popular. This was the beginning of the social revolution that ended up being called the 1960s, said Harold Leventhal, a musician's manager of the day. The bearded 6'2" rebel who nurtured these neophytes was an improbable muse. Fred Weintraub was born in 1928 in the Bronx, son of a baby carriage maker. He studied for his bar mitzvah with cantor Reuben Tucker, later known as Richard Tucker of the Metropolitan Opera. Weintraub expanded his dad's business to dozens of stores. He was living with his wife and daughters in Westchester County when, at the age of 26, he was struck by seeing the Fellini film La Strada. He left his wife and daughters for a freewheeling life, playing piano in a bordello, running a fishing boat in Cuba, and roaming Europe, before deciding Greenwich Village's music scene was where he belonged. Weintraub opened the Bitter End at 147 Bleecker Street in 1961. It had no liquor license, instead serving coffee and ice cream confections with names like Frosty Freud and Zen Sunday. His office was out front, his foot on the bumper of a parked car. Over the years, the Bitter End provided a stage to a parade of budding singers, including Harry Chapin, Neil Diamond, Bette Midler, and Carly Simon. Young comedians like Dick Cavett, George Carlin, Billy Crystal, Robert Klein, Joan Rivers, Lily Tomlin, and Flip Wilson. Woodstock was Weintraub's first project after moving to Warner Brothers. He later became a vice president for creative services. Roger Ebert called it the film that gave a generation a voice and made Woodstock a part of American myth. When the Woodstock Festival began in chaos, with miles-long traffic jams and rain-soaked fields, Weintraub was a laughingstock at Warner Brothers, but by the time the weekend ended and Woodstock had made history, he was lionized. His documentary became the sixth highest grossing film of 1970. By Monday morning, I was a bigger hero than Neil Armstrong, Weintraub recalled. All he did was walk on the moon. I saved Warner Brothers. The first film he produced through his own company was the Bruce Lee martial arts hit Enter the Dragon. Beginning the kung fu movie phenomenon, he went on to produce or write 50 films. Weintraub was supposed to play himself in the 1993 film Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, but at the Hollywood premiere, he was told that his footage had been cut from the final version. You weren't believable as Fred Weintraub, he recalled the director, Rob Cohen, telling him. Weintraub explained, in my defense, I've never pretended to be an actor, and Fred Weintraub is a mighty difficult role. He's passionate, unpredictable, lusty, mischievous, impatient, larger than life, and his backstory places him at the heart of more pop cultural milestones than seem possible for any one man. He's like Forrest Gump, played by Al Pacino. May he rest in peace. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Abigail Pogrebin, is a prominent Jewish thinker and author. Her new book is called My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew, in which she took the entire Jewish holiday cycle seriously and went to a different Jewish location, synagogue, and community for each of them. Her previous books include Stars of David, Prominent Jews Talk About Being Jewish, which explore Jewish identity in a very different way. I want to ask about something early in your book in which you explain how your son didn't want a bar mitzvah and then Rabbi Peter Rubenstein kind of talked him through that. Tell us a little bit about that. It's a great story.
Yeah, thank you. When my son was approaching his bar mitzvah, he had a terrible loss. It was a loss for all of us, where one of his friends, who was 10 years old, died of brain cancer, incurable. And I think the fact that that was happening concurrent with Ben's studies, in which, as you know, so much of the liturgy and the language is around praising God and feeling grateful, when he was feeling not so grateful, but very, very angry, very pained, and very baffled, frankly, by how this could happen. And his Parsha, actually, Leviticus Parsha, was very much about it's essentially a threat from God saying, if you do not follow my commandments, you will be punished. And for Ben to be studying that Parsha and trying to master it enough to write his own Devar Torah, his own, you know, essentially mini sermon for his service, was, you know, as you can imagine, kind of a crisis of faith, because he felt like, how can I reconcile the idea that a child would be punished who has not done anything yet? A 10-year-old, or he was 9 when he was diagnosed. And I really was at a loss. I mean, I didn't know how to talk him through this. I don't have your expertise. I don't really have language for doubt. And what I did was I appealed to my then senior rabbi, Peter Rubenstein, at Central Synagogue. And all he said was, let me talk to him. And Ben went in for one conversation, and that one conversation turned into a weekly conversation, which was extremely generous when you have 5,000 congregants for Rabbi Rubenstein to have done. But essentially, I think I say it in the book, or I certainly have said it privately, I feel like he kind of saved a Jew, because somehow in those conversations and the ability for Ben to be honest, the freedom and safety for Ben to be honest about his doubts, got him to the point where he chose to go through with the ceremony and wanted to become a bar mitzvah, wanted to be called to that bima. And it was, to me, one of those kind of twinkling moments where you see how powerful a great teacher, a great rabbi can be.
In going through the sequence of holidays, you observe some that I would bet a lot you'd never observed before, at Tzom Gedaliah. Which ones of the minor festivals struck you as most surprising or had additional meaning?
I would say, you know, the six fasts were admittedly not my favorite, because I'm a very enthusiastic eater, as many Jews are, as many people are. So I didn't relish that discipline. But, you know, as I think I said before, I think that there is something powerful even in the discomfort. And I learned very much, I would say, that each of those fasts absolutely makes you look at your own privileges and gifts and good fortune, and not in a way that necessarily just is a guilt trip, because I'm not a subscriber to that. It was more of a sense of savoring what you have and looking at moments and people who are in that moment suffering and don't have the same bounty that you have. So I would say overall, first of all, that was kind of a revelation in that sort of self-denial six times. But I would say, for instance, taking one of the fasts that I had never understood before, the 10th of Tevet, you know, there are four times where we fast for the destruction of the temple. And for this one, which is the siege, it marks the siege of the temple, so it's not yet destroyed. It's just the beginning. There was one rabbi, Yosef Blau, from Yeshiva University, who said that his takeaway from that lesson is that we should be very alert to the beginning of the bad thing, which I think is very, very apt in this moment that we're living in now. You know, pay attention to the clouds before the storm. Don't dismiss that something may not become terrible that looks worrisome. And that was a very powerful takeaway. And then similarly, another fast, it's closer to summer, the 17th of Tammuz, which is the breach of the temple when they have actually, you know,
broken through the walls.
Imminent. Yeah. Broken through the walls, exactly. And the Jews are isolated, you know, hemmed in and starving. And they know they're going to die. Someone named Alana Stein-Hain, who is a teacher at the Shalom Hartman Institute, said to me, you know, there's that moment that so many people are living in now between the suffering and the inevitability of the end and the fact that they're not there yet. And to think about the people who are in that liminal space. And I had a friend who was dying of cancer at the time, who had really small children, 3 and 5. And the fact that she knew that she wasn't going to make it, but she still had to be a mother for whatever time she had left. That, to me, brought home the 17th of Tammuz in a way that suddenly made it the most relevant holiday possible.
You write about some of the holidays in very surprising ways. We had you on here on Too Jewish early in this process, and what comes out in the book about Sukkot is very surprising indeed and very sexual. Can you tell us about how you came to that?
Yes, I think, you know, a cantor friend called it 50 Shades of Sukkot. this was very unexpected, and believe me, I was looking for variety, and I certainly wanted some entertainment, but I never expected this explanation. And I should preface it by saying a number of rabbis described this, so it wasn't just this one. But I interviewed Michael Paley, who, as you know, is the scholar in residence at the UJA Federation in New York, and he's a wonderful teacher, and, you know, can cite every source, you know, practically by heart. And he was talking about that it was a very, sexualized, the waving of the lulav and the etrog, the vegetable, and the citron, which looks like a lemon. They are sort of purposefully fertility echoing movements, and he starts to act them out. And it's too X-rated for your program, but
it's a good thing this is not a video podcast. It's just over the air radio.
I'm not acting it out right now, but of course that makes it come alive. And I had never actually done that ritual before, which feels very awkward for someone who doesn't do it easily. But when I kind of road tested it with other rabbis, they said, absolutely. There's so much imagery around fertility around this holiday. And it's not just the idea of agriculture and that what I've always known Sukkot to be, which is a very kind of happily decorated gourds and corns and things hanging from your sukkah, that there was another layer to it.
You had the privilege of meeting a lot of the most interesting rabbis and communities going today. Who impressed you the most?
That's such a hard question, because it's like, who's your favorite child?
Of course.
I was blown away. I mean, I would say, and this is not just, again, to give the politically correct answer, what amazed me more than anything were two things. Was, first of all, no rabbi said no. No rabbi turned me down. And I am saying I was reaching out to everyone from, you know, a Haredi rabbi, you know, the most observant, ultra-Orthodox, to renewal or even no label at all. Everyone said yes. And I think that's a powerful sign of your expertise and profession, which is, I'm here for you. I'll be your teacher. If you want to be taught, I am available. I found that extremely moving and profound. And the other part of it is that another testament to what you all do is that you have to reinvent something that comes around every year over and over again. And that discipline of finding meaning in the ancient and the redundant is something that I have more awe for than I ever did before. And what I would say is that everyone taught me something. And that was, I mean, clearly I was a ready learner, but there's tremendous power in that for me. For me to call someone up and say, you know, Shemini Atzeret, I don't really get it, especially in this day and age. Tell me why it should matter. And, you know, 2 hours later, still be talking about it on the phone. That, to me, is a powerful takeaway.
And, you know, A.J. Jacobs wrote the intro for you, the foreword for you, I should say. And he had that really fun book about kind of live biblically, in which he kind of, you know, adopted all of the biblical rules and tried to do them. Your approach was really quite different. What did you use to determine how you were going to look at these communities? Were you going to be the journalist? Were you going to be a participant?
That's a good question, really good question. I was definitely guided by my gut, and there's no question that I was experiencing it personally. So even though I am a pretty meticulous, anal journalist, meaning I want to make sure I've done my research, I want to make sure I've read a lot, talked to a lot of people before I go into something or go into an interview, I also wanted to be open to what I might feel. And so that was a very different kind of journalistic experience, was to really try to not prejudge, to not say, I don't understand this, I'm not feeling anything, but to really let myself say, you don't know what this year is going to bring, and you need to be open to whatever comes. I think that's true of life. I think it's harder in a way for a control freak like me, especially someone who knew I had to kind of write about this every step of the way. But there was a kind of leap of faith, and that's what guided me, is that somehow, as long as I was really hyper attuned to what I was feeling, I would have something to write about. And actually, it turned out to be I had too much to say about each holiday. I had to constantly kind of decide, what aspect of this do you really want to pursue? Because there's so many aspects of it that would often kind of electrify my thinking.
You know, it's fascinating. For me, the book works on many different levels. It does explain each of the holidays. You could use this in teaching basic Judaism, teaching people about the festivals. But it's also, in many ways, a personal memoir.
Yeah, I like that you say that. I wanted it to be personal because I think that's really the only way a book, first of all, is interesting. And second of all, it was true. It was true to who I am. I couldn't experience these holidays without admitting that I was losing my father-in-law during this year, or admitting that my son was going away to college after being under my roof for you know, 17 years. These were things that were happening in my life. They were absolutely informing how I experienced the holiday. But what I love about what you also said is I do want this to be something you can pick up and say, you know, I've never understood this Jewish system, this Jewish architecture. And whether you are a Jew or a non-Jew, or perhaps married to a non-Jew, or your partner is a non-Jew, this is, I think, sort of in one volume, and hopefully in a way that is lively, you will understand it at the end of this book.
I want to thank Abigail Pogrebin for a great visit. I feel like we could talk for another Jewish year about her book.
Me too.
It's called My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. Where can people go? I know they can get it on Amazon and everywhere else. Where can they go to?
I'm thrilled if they get it on Amazon, and it hopefully will be in bookstores, but it certainly is going to be on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
And where can people go to find out more about you?
Oh, I'm AbigailPogrebin.com. I have a website, and I will be speaking various places around the country, and I hope you'll come and introduce yourself.
I certainly hope so. Thanks so much again.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Susan Silverman, activist, woman of the wall, and author of the new book, Casting Lots, Creating a Family in a Beautiful Broken World, and an advocate for adoption.
Of course, listen to all our podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes from Paul Zim, a medley of melodies for the Purim prayer and song Al HaNisim for the miracles you, God, did for our people at this time of year in those days long ago. And don't miss the greatest Purim show in the world at Temple Emmanuel at 10 a.m. today, that is, in just a few minutes, right after Two Jewish. It's our version of Esther and the Hamantaschen Factory, a parody of Willy Wonka and tribute to the late Gene Wilder. You can watch the live stream at tetucson.org. My friends, have a happy holiday of Purim, a Chag Sameach, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
ועל הגבורות ועל התשועות ועל המלחמות שעשית לבותינו בימים מהם בזמן הזה. על הניסים ועל הפורקן ועל הגבורות ועל התשועות ועל המלחמות שעשית לבותינו.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.